This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to David Lehman, the author of A Fine Romance, Jewish Songwriters, American Songs. Hi, David. How are you?
Great. Nice to be here with you.
It's good to talk to you. Now, you're best known, I think, as a poet and editor. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what music has meant to you and how this sort of fits into your creative life?
From the time I was a boy, I loved the great classic American popular songs. And, you know, anything from Love and Marriage and High Hopes, which were songs in the 50s, to the score of Oklahoma or Carousel or Guys and Dolls, which I got to know very well at summer camp. And I was also a great Sinatra file in the 60s when everyone else was more into the Beatles. So this was always a big part of my life. I don't think I ever planned to write a book about the subject, but it happened. It's a subject that one doesn't exhaust one's interest in even after finishing writing a book.
So, but what got you to focus on the Jewishness of the music? I guess, I mean, aside from the fact that you are Jewish and it is true that a lot of these songwriters were Jewish, that's a lens that you used in this book to talk about the whole story of 20th century popular music. And I'm just curious what prompted you to go in that direction, because there are other lenses that you could have used.
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the surprise of finding out in a incremental and gradual way that these songs and shows were largely the product of Jewish songwriters. That is, when I first saw Oklahoma, I thought it was the most American thing you could have, you know, and had no idea that it was written by two Jewish fellows from the Upper West Side who had never been to that state. The Wizard of Oz, it never occurred to me
South
that...
South Pacific,
the whole list.
Right, so, I mean, there is that irony of all these Jewish immigrants, usually sometimes first generation, mostly second generation, creating the image of America that they absorbed when they came, but also they reinforce it by making it popular.
And I think it's that exact observation that is sort of the kernel, to make a pun on Jerry Kern, for the book I wrote. The idea that these outsiders were getting the chance to write the text and script of the American dream. I myself am the son of refugees, so I identified myself totally with people like Harold Arlen or Irving Berlin.
So do you think, I mean, you call it a fine romance, and there are many ways of looking at that. It's your romance with the writing or in the music, and it's their romance, and it's the romance is the subject of so many songs. But at its root, the music is completely romantic in the sense that it's the music is in love, and the writers are in love with America. They're in love with love, and that's maybe why people are so were so identified with this music, that it represented a period of time, you know, a sort of positivist time, although the Great Depression is in the middle of it, and you talk about that. But I guess I'm not sure what I'm getting at exactly, but I think it's the idea that romance is at the heart of all this music, to use another pun, because you have Larry Hart there.
Yes, we can't avoid them, and we should celebrate them. I think that the romantic element in these songs is something that we miss if we turn on the radio and listen to this stuff today. It's only one of the things we miss, but it's an important thing, because you go over the lyrics and you can see the celebration of romance, and not only in its jubilant stage, but also in the heartbreak stage. And you also have the idea of courtship and wooing that is one reason why these songs are so beloved by the people who remember them, who are a little older now, and one reason why I'd like to make the effort to revitalize the whole tradition. I'm not the only one. We have South Pacific running right now in New York, and it's a hell of a show. it's as great today as it ever was.
Well, so do you think that, I mean, you touch on this in the book, but do you think that the period of this music, which probably is defined as maybe 1915 to 1960, 65, somewhere in there, so it's a full half century, that's the flowering of it. It may be that like popular music reflects the period that it comes from. So 1963 with the killing of Kennedy, 1968 with the killings of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, those sort of mark the end of the innocent era of America. And maybe that's why this music no longer spoke to people of that era.
No doubt it's a combination of the things you mentioned and the war in Vietnam, the Watergate scandal, the youth rebellion, and the sort of enfranchisement of young people to determine the taste of the nation. That also has played a part in the transformation of what popular music is. So it may be that these great songs are faded to a kind of repertory status, the way Puccini's operas and Verdi's operas are.
Which is, it's still no less alive in the culture. It still has a role to play, but it can't, I mean, in some sense, it can't ever be what it was because, you know, the generations move on. And if it did reflect the yearnings of a particular category of people in the making of it and the fact that it was so popular because they were in tune with their audience, maybe changes. But I think clearly the universality goes on. In some of these songs have been sung by every singer that ever lived over and over again and just reinterpreted.
Well, it's one of the great things about the songs that they're so flexible. They can be sung in any tempo, any time signature, any style, really. You could take all the things you are and have Helen Forrest sing it with Artie Shaw's band. And then you could have Barbara Streisand sing the same song. You could have a full-blown operatic version as John McGlynn, the late John McGlynn, would do with the London Sinfonietta and the Ambrosian Chorus. So the same song can be done so many different ways, and they're immortal.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Well, you talked a lot about that in the book, I think. You know, the way that the song, I think that what was interesting is seeing in the book the lyrics that you quoted, how brilliant some of them were as lyrics. And you were very, I thought one of the things you talked about was interesting, the difference between poetry and lyrics, you know, that there is a difference. I think that some people, you know, today will say Bob Dylan is the greatest poet of his generation, and I would argue he was a great songwriter, not necessarily a great poet. Two different things. And you talked about that a lot.
I do talk about that in Fine Romance. I also wrote a essay about it for the American Scholar magazine because I was thinking of Irving Berlin's song Always, which begins, I'll be loving you always. And, you know, George S. Kaufman wanted him to change that to I'll be loving you next Tuesday, and which is a more interesting poetic line. But it's not as good a line to open the song Always. And then I remember that Auden wrote that I love you forever is an easy thing to say and therefore a less poetically valuable thing to say than I will love you next Tuesday at 4:15 p.m. So I wrote this piece about these two points of view. But I think you can love Auden and you can love Irving Berlin.
Right. Well, and they are different. Poetry is very different from a song.
Totally. But one can love them both. It's a hard one to figure out entirely. But I'm a poet. I love poetry. But if I had been born 50 years sooner, I think my ambition would have been to write lyrics for Harold Arlen or Burton Lane. I don't know that I would have been good at it or good enough. Someone told Sammy Kahn that he was the 17th best lyricist in Hollywood, which sounds like an awful put-down until you And so you realize that you have Ira Gershwin and Larry Hart and Oscar Hammerstein and Dorothy Fields and Johnny Mercer and 10 other, Leo Robin and, you know, Gus Kahn. So to be 17 on that list is pretty good.
Right, it's pretty extraordinary. But a lot of the things you talk, the other things that you talked about in the book that I thought were really interesting, you talk about the relationship between Jewish experience and black experience because of the connection between this music and black music, the blues, jazz. I thought that was a pretty interesting area for, you know, and I think that, let's see, what else? I think that you also talked about politics. I mean, this is a pretty, you know, I think it's a good mechanism for you as a writer to use this as a it's almost like a meditation, personal meditation, so you can bring in almost everything that that you've thought about. And in the book, you mix a sort of factual and fantastical, where you have your uncles, who are really, I think it was Arlen and Kern. And, you know, there were times in the book I wasn't sure, you know, were they really talking to you? Did you really interview them? But I thought it was very, I mean, it was a very, it made it more interesting to me that you were not linear. This was not, this is not a recording of history. It's more of a imaginative, personal approach to the music because it is, for you, the music that, you know, moves you.
Well, you know, I've written a number of nonfiction books before, and in each case, the subject was pretty new and hadn't been written about, at least for a general audience. But with this book on the American Songbook, there have been so many books already written that you have to adopt a different kind of strategy. And originally, when I just began writing, I thought, well, I'll have six chapters, one on Hammerstein, one on Hart, one on Dorothy Fields, one on Yip Harburg. And I mentioned this to one of my editors who said, you're a poet. Be a poet. Don't do it that way. And that was a great piece of advice. And the sentence that created the book, that sort of began the first sentence I wrote was that Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen were my uncles in the synagogue I attended as a boy. And that was this, a terrific moment for me as a writer because it opened up this whole possibility of incorporating fantastic or fantasy elements and fiction elements into what is basically a nonfiction true book. I had to keep myself interested, but I also want, you know, I believe that the more fun you have writing a book, the more fun the reader will have. And so I tried all sorts of things, including, like, what was going on in the world when Kern's They Didn't Believe Me, you know, made its debut on the Broadway stage? Or when God Bless America was sung for the first time by Kate Smith on the radio, what was going on that day? And it turns out that something really significant was going on. And so I tried to put in this historical context.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about God Bless America, because I thought, you know, that is a pretty interesting story.
Well, he had written it originally in during the First World War, and he felt in 1938...
This is Irving Berlin.
Yes, we're talking about Uncle Irving now.
Right.
Irving Berlin felt that that we needed another patriotic song. This is in the late 1930s. We're fighting a kind of ideological and cultural war with the Nazis, and of course a hot war will soon follow. And Irving fished out of his trunk this old tune that had no title, made some adjustments, and out came God Bless America. And he gave it to Kate Smith, who had this very popular radio show. And on November 11, 1938, exactly the 20th anniversary of the armistice ending World War I, she sings it on the radio. That's also the day that you read in the papers about the pogroms in Europe that the Nazis organized that became known as Kristallnacht in Germany and Austria. So this is not just a coincidence. This is a really interesting concatenation of events.
Yeah, no, speaking of Irving Berlin. How do you, you know, kind of prompts me to wonder which of the, is there a sort of pantheon for you of these people? Not just, you know, how do they fit in? You know, which ones matter the most to you? And you talked, I mean, in the book, obviously, you talk about a lot of them. And clearly, you spent a lot of time with Lawrence Hart, so you, or Larry Hart, you think, yeah, I mean, he's meaningful to you, and Oscar Hammerstein is meaningful to you. But there are a lot of these guys, and, you know, they sort of, there is a pantheon, you know, if they're the demigods of this kind of music. Is Irving Berlin the key for you, or is it somebody else?
Well, there is a hierarchy, although I'm also very democratic in a way. In my hierarchy, the great geniuses are Jerome Kern and Richard Rodgers, and of course George Gershwin and Harold Arlen and Irving Berlin and Cole Porter.
And Cole Porter, you allow in, even though he's not Jewish, as you point out.
Well, yes, I also don't mean to denigrate the many great non-Jewish writers, Walter Donaldson and Vincent Humans and John Mercer and Hoagy Carmichael, one of the greatest songwriters. There are lots of them. They all got along, too, and they collaborated, which is really interesting to me because I believe in collaboration as an ideal in artistic creation. But I love those musicians, and I didn't even mention the lyricists like Larry Hart, Ira Gershwin, another one of my favorites. Dorothy Fields, I think, is wonderful.
And you mentioned
Kay
Swift kind of in passing.
Oh, yes, that's right. She did Can't We Be Friends, Kay Swift. She's Gershwin's lady love.
And just by total happenstance, one of the interviews I did most recently is with a writer named Catherine Weber, who wrote a novel called True Confections. Kay Swift is her grandmother.
Is that so?
It was just funny to find that out.
Oh, that's interesting. I met Catherine Weber at a party. I had no idea. That's very interesting. One anecdote in my book is that, you know, George Gershwin was such a bon vivant and confirmed bachelor that he dated lots of women, but the one that he was seen with most often was Kay Swift. And he had this great friend, Oscar Levant, who was a great wit. And one day, George and Kay Swift came to a party, and Oscar said, here comes George with the future Miss Kay Swift.
No, I love that. It was a great – that is a terrific line. That one sort of stood out for me in the book.
That's Oscar Levant.
Yeah. Well, let me talk a little bit about the other thing that you mention in the book is a couple of singers. Not, most of the book is about the songwriters and the lyricists, but you talk about Mel Torme. And you talk a lot about Frank Sinatra. So maybe you could talk a little bit about Mel Torme, because I think his story is really interesting.
Well, to me, Sinatra is the great American singer and also the person who really fascinates me most of all the singers. Of course, I'm scarcely alone in feeling that way. But Mel Torme is a tremendous jazz singer and a great performer and entertainer. And I find him to be very, very Jewish, whatever that means. In my fantasy, he was the greatest bar mitzvah boy of all time. He performed that Saturday like nobody else could. He's a wonderful singer, and he's great at scatting. I think only Ella is the superior at that. Mel Torme did a version of Mountain Greenery, the Rodgers and Hart song that I've never heard anyone else do all the lyrics to that song. There are many more verses than people realize. It's one of their masterpieces, Rodgers and Hart. It came a year after Manhattan. It came in 1926, and it's the bucolic country version of the Manhattan story. Manhattan is about, we'll have Manhattan because we don't have the money to go away for the summer. And Mountain Greenery is, we're going to go to some little cabin in the Catskills, and what fun we'll have. Just tremendous the way Mel does it. Mel also, well, of course, he wrote the Christmas song, you know, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. He wrote the music with Bob Wells, the lyrics, on an exceptionally hot day in August of 1945, when Mel was barely 20 years old. which is sort of extraordinary. And it also interested me that all those great Christmas songs are written during the summer.
Right, and it is also ironic how many Christmas songs are written by Jews.
Well, and the first is Irving Berlin's White Christmas, which is a phenomenal success, also because all the GIs are abroad now, and this song means a great deal to them. It means not only Christmas, but home, America. And he writes this song in a way that makes it possible to apply to people of all religions and backgrounds. The word Christmas is in the song, but otherwise it's about a snow day, really. And it becomes a kind of secular holiday. And everyone loved that song. And then the next year you had, 2 years later, I guess, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And another one was I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Yeah, I wonder if you sort of imagine those guys. You know, partly it is the image we have of the songwriters in Tin Pan Alley, the literal Tin Pan Alley from movies about it. You know, they're sitting there, you know, with their cigars, and, you know, they're saying, let's do a song about Christmas. We need a song about Christmas.
Yes.
But a lot of these songs really came from musicals, Broadway musicals. So there's this sort of interplay between the popular song as individual commodity, and then there's the Broadway musical, which defines American theater for this huge period of time. And then, of course, as you talk about, too, there's the movies, and which I think the one thing I wanted to, last thing I wanted to bring up is Al Jolson, because that gave you an opportunity to talk about the complexity of his relationship to the music and blackface. And, you know, I thought that was really good. I think the complication of race and culture and, you know, who is what and how do you, what face are you showing? The story of Al Jolson
in the jazz
singer is really, it's just an amazing story, the way you laid it out. I've seen the movie many times, but I think you did a really good job with that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think Al Jolson is really a great singer and a great entertainer. And if you have a chance to listen to his versions of Swanee or After You've Gone, you're in for a treat, especially because there is no one I've ever heard who can whistle like Al Jolson. He makes it sound like a chorus of birds is flying around the room. It's really amazing.
And this was not multi-tracked.
No. Well, he's the son of a cantor, Al Jolson, right, as was Irving Berlin, as was Harold Arlen. And the movie The Jazz Singer is about a cantor's son, just like Jolson. And there's one moment in the film where he has to choose between an appearance in a great Broadway show and substituting for his cantor father in synagogue on Kol Nidre, the holiest night of the year in the Jewish calendar, the eve of Yom Kippur. And he's not sure which to do, and he's not sure of who he is. And it's in that scene that he puts on blackface. He's between two identities, and he's putting on a mask. And in some ways, that's one of the great iconic American moments altogether of who we are as a nation, because we come out of all of these different immigrant movements, and we're sort of the sum of all of these parts, but how do we fit together? So he's neither one thing nor the other when he puts the blackface on, but that also allows him to be himself. Oscar Wilde said, give a man a mask and he'll tell you the truth, and Jolson puts on a mask. Now, I know it's controversial that, understandably, people of color are going to be very sensitive about blackface, whether it's Fred Astaire in Swing Time being Bojangles of Harlem or Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer. But I think in the end, the music and the performances are so grand and so uplifting that it transcends these particular sensitivities, and that we can all embrace them. You know, there used to be protests against Porgy and Bess by George and Ira Gershwin with DuBose Hayward, the opera they did in 1935. But if you think about it, Gershwin insisted on an all-black cast. He gave a lot of work to a lot of singers and actors who would not be employed by any means. And also, though it may be found objectionable that there are stereotypes in Porgy and Bess, the drug dealer, the shiftless character, in the end, though, the music is so sublime, the lyrics so extraordinarily clever, that I think it's a classic, and I think that anyone who has a chance to play in it will be very grateful.
You think it overcomes the, you know, the sense of appropriating somebody else's culture because it is respectful of the culture and also evocative in a positive way?
Oh yes, it's done at the Metropolitan Opera. I saw it there a few years ago. I'd like to see it every year if I could. You know, when I heard Frank Sinatra sing Where's My Bess, a recording from the early 40s, and it is really quite amazing. But and it's quite wonderful, too, that a song written by Jews about blacks can be sung by an Italian-American. That too, is the American dream.
Right, and I think that's really what your book is about. So I really thank you for talking to me, David Lehman, about A Fine Romance.
And I didn't even tell you half the anecdotes that I had planned, including the one about London that happened last weekend.
I know, we ran out of time, and maybe we can have another conversation, because this book, it shows you, it's a fairly small book, but there's a lot to say. A lot in it and a lot to say about it. I really appreciate your time.
Well, I love talking to you, and also I love meeting the son of the man who wrote They're Playing Our Song, Max Wilk, which is one of my favorite books. It's a really great book.
Thanks for mentioning it. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast, talking to David Lehman, author of A Fine Romance. Thanks.